informed that a great number of the soldiers had already consecrated their swords to the service of Christ and of Constantine. The habits of mankind and the interests of religion gradually abated the horror of war and bloodshed, which had so long prevailed among the Christians. And in the councils which were assembled under the gracious protection of Constantine, the authority of the bishops was seasonably employed to ratify the obligation of the military oath, and to inflict the penalty of excommunication on those soldiers who threw away their arms during the peace of the church. While Constantine in his own dominions increased the number and zeal of his faithful adherents, he could depend on the support of a powerful faction in those provinces which were still possessed or usurped by his rivals. A secret disaffection was diffused among the Christian subjects of Maxentius and Licinius, and the resentment which the latter did not attempt to conceal served only to engage them still more deeply in the interest of his competitor. The regular correspondence which connected the bishops of the most distant provinces enabled them freely to communicate their wishes and their designs, and to transmit without danger any useful intelligence or any pious contributions which might promote the service of Constantine, who publicly declared that he had taken up arms for the deliverance of the church. The enthusiasm which inspired the troops, and perhaps the emperor himself, had sharpened their swords while it satisfied their conscience. They marched to battle with the full assurance that the same God who had formerly opened a passage to the Israelites through the waters of Jordan and had thrown down the walls of Jericho at the sound of the trumpets of Joshua would display his visible majesty and power in the victory of Constantine. The evidence of ecclesiastical history is prepared to affirm that their expectations were justified by the conspicuous miracle to which the conversion of the first Christian emperor has been almost unanimously ascribed. The real or imaginary cause of so important an event deserves and demands the attention of posterity, and I shall endeavour to form a just estimate of the famous vision of Constantine by a distinct consideration of the standard, the dream, and the celestial sign, by separating the historical, the natural, and the marvelous parts of this extraordinary story, which in the composition of a specious argument have been artfully confounded in one splendid and brittle mass. An instrument of the tortures which were inflicted only on slaves and strangers became an object of horror in the eyes of a Roman citizen, and the ideas of guilt, of pain, and of ignominy were closely united with the idea of the cross. The piety, rather than the humanity, of Constantine soon abolished in his dominions the punishment which the Saviour of mankind had condescended to suffer. But the emperor had already learned to despise the prejudices of his education and of his people before he could erect in the midst of Rome his own statue bearing a cross in its right hand, with an inscription which referred the victory of his arms and the deliverance of Rome to the virtue of that salutary sign, the true symbol of force and courage. The same symbol sanctified the arms of the soldiers of Constantine. The cross glittered on their helmet, was engraved on their shields, was interwoven into their banners, and the consecrated emblems which adorned the person of the emperor himself were distinguished only by richer materials and more exquisite workmanship. But the principal standard which displayed the triumph of the cross was styled the Labarum, an obscure, though celebrated name, which has been vainly derived from almost all the languages of the world. It is described as a long pike intersected by a transversal beam. The silken veil, which hung down from the beam, was curiously inwrought with the images of the reigning monarch and his children. The summit of the pike supported a crown of gold, which enclosed the mysterious monogram, at once expressive of the figure of the cross and the initial letters of the name of Christ. The safety of the Labarum was entrusted to 50 guards of approved valor and fidelity. Their station was marked by honors and emoluments, and some fortunate accidents soon introduced an opinion that as long as the guards of the Labarum were engaged in the execution of their office, they were secure and invulnerable amid the darts of the enemy. In the Second Civil War, Licinius felt and dreaded the power of this consecrated banner, the sight of which, in the distress of battle, animated the soldiers of Constantine with an invincible enthusiasm, and scattered terror and dismay through the ranks of the adverse legions. The Christian emperors, who respected the example of Constantine, displayed in all their military expeditions the standard of the cross. But when the degenerate successors of Theodosius had ceased to appear in person at the head of their armies, the Labarum was deposited as a venerable but useless relic in the palace of Constantinople. Its honors are still preserved on the medals of the Flavian family. Their grateful devotion has placed the monogram of Christ in the midst of the ensigns of Rome. The solemn epithets of safety of the Republic, glory of the army, restoration of public happiness, are equally applied to the religious and military trophies, and there is still extant a medal of the Emperor Constantius, where the standard of the Labarum is accompanied with these memorable words, "By this sign thou shalt conquer." In all occasions of danger and distress, it was the practice of the primitive Christians to fortify their minds and bodies by the sign of the cross, which they used in all their ecclesiastical rites, in all the daily occurrences of life, as an infallible preservative against every species of spiritual or temporal evil. The authority of the Church might alone have had sufficient weight to justify the devotion of Constantine, who, in the same prudent and gradual progress, acknowledged the truth and assumed the symbol of Christianity. But the testimony of a contemporary writer who, in a formal treatise, has avenged the cause of religion, bestows on the piety of the emperor a more awful and sublime character. He affirms, with the most perfect confidence, that in the night which preceded the last battle against Maxentius, Constantine was admonished in a dream to inscribe the shields of his soldiers with the celestial sign of God, the sacred monogram of the name of Christ, that he executed the commands of heaven, and that his valor and obedience were rewarded by the decisive victory of the Milvian Bridge. Some considerations might perhaps incline a skeptical mind to suspect the judgment or the veracity of the rhetorician, whose pen, either from zeal or interest, was devoted to the cause of the prevailing faction. He appears to have published his Deaths of the Persecutors at Nicomedia about 3 years after the Roman victory, but the interval of 1,000 miles and 1,000 days will allow an ample latitude for the invention of declaimers, the credulity of party, and the tacit approbation of the emperor himself, who might listen without indignation to a marvelous tale which exalted his fame and promoted his designs. In favor of Licinius, who still dissembled his animosity to the Christians, the same author has provided a similar vision of a form of prayer, which was communicated by an angel and repeated by the whole army before they engaged the legions of the tyrant Maximin. The frequent repetition of miracles serves to provoke, where it does not subdue, the reason of mankind. But if the dream of Constantine is separately considered, it may be naturally explained either by the policy or the enthusiasm of the emperor. While his anxiety for the approaching day, which must decide the fate of the empire, was suspended by a short and interrupted slumber, the venerable form of Christ and the well-known symbol of his religion might forcibly offer themselves to the active fancy of a prince who reverenced the name and had perhaps secretly implored the power of the God of the Christians. As readily might a consummate statesman indulge himself in the use of one of those military stratagems, one of those pious frauds which Philip and Sertorius had employed with such art and effect. The preternatural origin of dreams was universally admitted by the nations of antiquity, and a considerable part of the Gallic army was already prepared to place their confidence in the salutary sign of the Christian religion. The secret vision of Constantine could be disproved only by the event, and the intrepid hero who had passed the Alps and the Apennine might view with careless despair the consequences of a defeat under the walls of Rome. The Senate and people, exulting in their own deliverance from an odious tyrant, acknowledged that the victory of Constantine surpassed the powers of man, without daring to insinuate that it had been obtained by the protection of the gods. The triumphal arch, which was erected about 3 years after the event, proclaims in ambiguous language that by the greatness of his own mind, and by an instinct or impulse of the divinity, he had saved and avenged the Roman Republic. The pagan orator, who had seized an earlier opportunity of celebrating the virtues of the conqueror, supposes that he alone enjoyed a secret and intimate commerce with the supreme being, who delegated the care of mortals to his subordinate deities, and thus assigns a very plausible reason why the subjects of Constantine should not presume to embrace the new religion of their sovereign. The philosopher, who with calm suspicion examines the dreams and omens, the miracles and prodigies of profane or even of ecclesiastical history, will probably conclude that if the eyes of the spectators have sometimes been deceived by fraud, the understanding of the readers has much more frequently been insulted by fiction. Every event, or appearance, or accident which seems to deviate from the ordinary course of nature has been rashly ascribed to the immediate action of the deity, and the astonished fancy of the multitude has sometimes given shape and color, language and motion to the fleeting but uncommon meteors of the air. Nazarius and Eusebius are the two most celebrated orators who, in studied panegyrics, have labored to exalt the glory of Constantine. 9 years after the Roman victory, Nazarius describes an army of divine warriors who seem to fall from the sky. He marks their beauty, their spirit, their gigantic forms, the stream of light which beamed from their celestial armor, their patience in suffering themselves to be heard as well as seen by mortals, and their declaration that they were sent, that they flew to the assistance of the great Constantine. For the truth of this prodigy, the pagan orator appeals to the whole Gallic nation in whose presence he was then speaking, and seems to hope that the ancient apparitions would now obtain credit from this recent and public event. The Christian fable of Eusebius, which in the space of 26 years might arise from the original dream, is cast in a much more correct and elegant mould. In one of the marches of Constantine, he is reported to have seen with his own eyes the luminous trophy of the cross placed above the meridian sun and inscribed with the following words, "By this conquer." This amazing object in the sky astonished the whole army, as well as the emperor himself, who was yet undetermined in the choice of a religion. But his astonishment was converted into faith by the vision of the ensuing night. Christ appeared before his eyes, and displaying the same celestial sign of the cross, he directed Constantine to frame a similar standard and to march with an assurance of victory against Maxentius and all his enemies. The learned bishop of Caesarea appears to be sensible that the recent discovery of this marvelous anecdote would excite some surprise and distrust among the most pious of his readers. Yet instead of ascertaining the precise circumstances of time and place, which always serve to detect falsehood or establish truth, instead of collecting and recording the evidence of so many living witnesses who must have been spectators of this stupendous miracle, Eusebius contents himself with alleging a very singular testimony, that of the deceased Constantine, who, many years after the event, in the freedom of conversation, had related to him this extraordinary incident of his own life, and had attested the truth of it by solemn oath. The prudence and gratitude of the learned prelate forbade him to suspect the veracity of his victorious master. but he plainly intimates that in a fact of such a nature he should have refused his assent to any meaner authority. This motive of credibility could not survive the power of the Flavian family, and the celestial sign which the infidels might afterwards deride was disregarded by the Christians of the age which immediately followed the conversion of Constantine. But the Catholic Church, both of the East and of the West, has adopted a prodigy which favors, or seems to favor, the popular worship of the cross. The vision of Constantine maintained an honorable place in the legend of superstition, till the bold and sagacious spirit of criticism presumed to depreciate the triumph and to arraign the truth of the first Christian emperor. The Protestant and philosophic readers of the present age will incline to believe that in the account of his own conversion, Constantine attested a willful falsehood by a solemn and deliberate perjury. They may not hesitate to pronounce that in the choice of a religion, his mind was determined only by sense of interest, and that, according to the expression of a profane poet, he used the altars of the church as a convenient footstool to the throne of the empire. A conclusion so harsh and so absolute is not, however, warranted by our knowledge of human nature, of Constantine, or of Christianity. In an age of religious fervor, the most artful statesmen are observed to feel some part of the enthusiasm which they inspire, and the most orthodox saints assume the dangerous privilege of defending the cause of truth by the arms of deceit and falsehood. Personal interest is often the standard of our belief, as well as of our practice, and the same motives of temporal advantage which might influence the public conduct and professions of Constantine would insensibly dispose his mind to embrace a religion so propitious to his fame and fortunes. His vanity was gratified by the flattering assurance that he had been chosen by heaven to reign over the earth. Success had justified his divine title to the throne, and that title was founded on the truth of the Christian revelation. As real virtue is sometimes excited by undeserved applause, the specious piety of Constantine, if at first it was only specious, might gradually, by the influence of praise, of habit, and of example, be matured into serious faith and fervent devotion. The bishops and teachers of the new sect, whose dress and manners had not qualified them for the residence of a court, were admitted to the imperial table. They accompanied the monarch in his expeditions, and the ascendant which one of them, an Egyptian or a Spaniard, acquired over his mind, was imputed by the pagans to the effect of magic. Lactantius, who has adorned the precepts of the gospel with the eloquence of Cicero, and Eusebius, who has consecrated the learning and philosophy of the Greeks to the service of religion, were both received into the friendship and familiarity of their sovereign. And those able masters of controversy could patiently watch the soft and yielding moments of persuasion and dexterously apply the arguments which were the best adapted to his character and understanding. Whatever advantages might be derived from the acquisition of an imperial proselyte, he was distinguished by the splendor of his purple rather than by the superiority of his wisdom or virtue from the many thousands of his subjects who had embraced the doctrines of Christianity. Nor can it be deemed incredible that the mind of an unlettered soldier should have yielded to the weight of evidence which, in a more enlightened age, has satisfied or subdued the reason of a Grotius, a Pascal, or a Locke. In the midst of the incessant labors of his great office, this soldier employed, or affected to employ, the hours of the night in the diligent study of the scriptures and the composition of theological discourses, which he afterwards pronounced in the presence of a numerous and applauding audience. In a very long discourse which is still extant, the royal preacher expatiates on the various proofs still extant. The royal preacher expatiates on the various proofs of religion. But he dwells with peculiar complacency on the Sibylline verses and the fourth eclogue of Virgil. 40 years before the birth of Christ, the Mantuan bard, as if inspired by the celestial muse of Isaiah, had celebrated with all the pomp of Oriental metaphor the return of the Virgin, the fall of the serpent, the approaching birth of a godlike child, the offspring of the great Jupiter, who should expiate the guilt of humankind and govern the peaceful universe with the virtues of his father. The rise and appearance of a heavenly race, primitive nation throughout the world, and the gradual restoration of the innocence and felicity of the Golden Age. The poet was perhaps unconscious of the secret sense and object of these sublime predictions, which have been so unworthily applied to the infant son of a consul or a triumvir. But if a more splendid and indeed specious interpretation of the fourth eclogue contributed to the conversion of the first Christian emperor, Virgil may deserve to be ranked among the most successful missionaries of the gospel. The awful mysteries of the Christian faith and worship were concealed from the eyes of strangers, and even of catechumens, with an affected secrecy which served to excite their wonder and curiosity. But the severe rules of discipline which the prudence of the bishops had instituted were relaxed by the same prudence in favor of an imperial proselyte, whom it was so important to allure by every gentle condescension into the pale of the church. And Constantine was permitted, at least by a tacit dispensation, to enjoy most of the privileges before he had contracted any of the obligations of a Christian. Instead of retiring from the congregation when the voice of the deacon dismissed the profane multitude, he prayed with the faithful, disputed with the bishops, preached on the most sublime and intricate subjects of theology, celebrated with sacred rites the vigil of Easter, and publicly declared himself not only a partaker, but in some measure, a priest and hierophant of the Christian mysteries. The pride of Constantine might assume, and his services had deserved, some extraordinary distinction, and ill-timed rigor might have blasted the unripened fruits of his conversion. And if the doors of the church had been strictly closed against a prince who had deserted the altars of the gods, the master of the empire would have been left destitute of any form of religious worship. In his last visit to Rome, he piously disclaimed and insulted the superstition of his ancestors by refusing to lead the military procession of the equestrian order and to offer the public vows to the Jupiter of the Capitoline Hill. Many years before his baptism and death, Constantine had proclaimed to the world that neither his person nor his image should evermore be seen within the walls of an idolatrous temple, while he distributed through the provinces a variety of medals and pictures which represented the emperor in a humble and suppliant posture of Christian devotion. The pride of Constantine, who refused the privileges of a catechumen, cannot easily be explained or excused. But the delay of his baptism may be justified by the maxims and the practice of ecclesiastical antiquity. The sacrament of baptism was regularly administered by the bishop himself with his assistant clergy in the cathedral church of the diocese during the 50 days between the solemn festivals of Easter and Pentecost. And this holy term admitted a numerous band of infants and adult persons into the bosom of the church. The discretion of parents often suspended the baptism of their children till they could understand the obligations which they contracted. The severity of ancient bishops exacted from the new converts a novitiate of 2 or 3 years, and the catechumens themselves, from different motives of a temporal or a spiritual nature, were seldom impatient to assume the character of perfect and initiated Christians. The sacrament of baptism was supposed to contain a full and absolute expiation of sin, and the soul was instantly restored to its original purity and entitled to the promise of eternal salvation. Among the proselytes of Christianity, there are many who judged it imprudent to precipitate a salutary rite, which could not be repeated, to throw away an inestimable privilege which could never be recovered. By the delay of their baptism, they could venture freely to indulge their passions in the enjoyments of this world, while they still retained in their own hands the means of a sure and easy absolution. The sublime theory of the gospel had made a much fainter impression on the heart than on the understanding of Constantine himself. He pursued the great object of his ambition through the dark and bloody paths of war and policy, and after the victory he abandoned himself without moderation to the abuse of his fortune. Instead of asserting his just superiority above the imperfect heroism and profane philosophy of Trajan and the Antonines, the mature age of Constantine forfeited the reputation which he had acquired in his youth. As he gradually advanced in the knowledge of truth, he proportionally declined in the practice of virtue, and the same year of his reign in which he convened the Council of Nice was polluted by the execution, or rather murder, of his eldest son. This date is alone sufficient to refute the ignorant and malicious suggestions of Zosimus, who affirms that after the death of Crispus, the remorse of his father accepted from the ministers of Christianity the expiation which he had vainly solicited from the pagan pontiffs. At the time of the death of Crispus, the emperor could no longer hesitate in the choice of a religion. He could no longer be ignorant that the church was possessed of an infallible remedy, though he chose to defer the application of it till the approach of death had removed the temptation and danger of a relapse. The bishops whom he summoned in his last illness to the palace of Nicomedia were edified by the fervor with which he requested and received the sacrament of baptism, by the solemn protestation that the remainder of his life should be worthy of a disciple of Christ, and by his humble refusal to wear the imperial purple after he had been clothed in the white garment of a neophyte. The example and reputation of Constantine seemed to countenance the delay of baptism. Future tyrants were encouraged to believe that the innocent blood which they might shed in a long reign would instantly be washed away in the waters of regeneration, and the abuse of religion dangerously undermined the foundations of moral virtue. The gratitude of the church has exalted the virtues and excused the failings of a generous patron who seated Christianity on the throne of the Roman world, and the Greeks, who celebrated the festival of the imperial saint, seldom mention the name of Constantine without adding the title of equal to the apostles. Such a comparison, if it allude to the character of those divine missionaries, must be imputed to the extravagance of impious flattery. But if the parallel be confined to the extent and number of their evangelic victories, the success of Constantine might perhaps equal that of the apostles themselves. By the edicts of toleration, he removed the temporal disadvantages which had hitherto retarded the progress of Christianity, and its active and numerous ministers received a free permission, a liberal encouragement, to recommend the salutary truths of revelation by every argument which could affect the reason or piety of mankind. The exact balance of the two religions continued but a moment, and the piercing eye of ambition and avarice soon discovered that the profession of Christianity might contribute to the interest of the present as well as of a future life. The hopes of wealth and honors, the example of an emperor, his exhortations, his irresistible smiles, diffused conviction among the venal and obsequious crowds which usually fill the apartments of a palace. The cities which signalized a forward zeal by the voluntary destruction of their temples were distinguished by municipal privileges and rewarded with popular donatives. And the new capital of the East gloried in the singular advantage that Constantinople was never profaned by the worship of idols. As the lower ranks of society are governed by imitation, the conversion of those who possessed any eminence of birth, of power, or of riches, was soon followed by dependent multitudes. The salvation of the common people was purchased at an easy rate, if it be true that in 1 year 12,000 men were baptized at Rome, besides a proportionable number of women and children, and that a white garment with 20 pieces of gold had been promised by the emperor to every convert. The powerful influence of Constantine was not circumscribed by the narrow limits of his life or of his dominions. The education which he bestowed on his sons and nephews secured to the empire a race of princes whose faith was still more lively and sincere, as they imbibed in their earliest infancy the spirit, or at least the doctrine, of Christianity. War and commerce had spread the knowledge of the gospel beyond the confines of the Roman provinces, and the barbarians, who had disdained a humble and proscribed sect, soon learned to esteem a religion which had been so lately embraced by the greatest monarch and the most civilized nation of the globe. The Goths and Germans who enlisted under the standard of Rome revered the cross which glittered at the head of the legions, and their fierce countrymen received at the same time the lessons of faith and of humanity. The kings of Iberia and Armenia worshipped the god of their protector, and their subjects, who have invariably preserved the name of Christians, soon formed a sacred and perpetual connection with their Roman brethren. The Christians of Persia were suspected, in time of war, of preferring their religion to their country. But as long as peace subsisted between the two empires, the persecuting spirit of the Magi was effectually restrained by the interposition of Constantine. The rays of the gospel illuminated the coast of India. The colonies of Jews who had penetrated into Arabia and Ethiopia opposed the progress of Christianity. But the labor of the missionaries was in some measure facilitated by previous knowledge of the Mosaic revelation. And Abyssinia still reveres the memory of Frumentius, who, in the time of Constantine, devoted his life to the conversion of those sequestered regions. Under the reign of his son Constantius, Theophilus, who was himself of Indian extraction, was invested with the double character of ambassador and bishop. He embarked on the Red Sea with 200 horses of the purest breed of Cappadocia, which were sent by the emperor to the prince of the Sabaeans, or Homerites. Theophilus was entrusted with many other useful or curious presents which might raise the admiration and conciliate the friendship of the barbarians, and he successfully employed several years in a pastoral visit to the churches of the torrid zone. The irresistible power of the Roman emperors was displayed in the important and dangerous change of the national religion. The terrors of a military force silenced the faint and unsupported murmurs of the pagans, and there was reason to expect that the cheerful submission of the Christian clergy, as well as people, would be the result of conscience and gratitude. It was long since established as a fundamental maxim of the Roman constitution that every rank of citizens was alike subject to the laws, and that the care of religion was the right, as well as duty, of the civil magistrate. Constantine and his successors could not easily persuade themselves that they had forfeited, by their conversion, any branch of the imperial prerogatives, or that they were incapable of giving laws to a religion which they had protected and embraced. The emperors still continued to exercise a supreme jurisdiction over the ecclesiastical order, and the 16th book of the Theodosian Code represents, under a variety of titles, the authority which they assumed in the government of the Catholic Church. But the distinction of the spiritual and temporal powers, which had never been imposed on the free spirit of Greece and Rome, was introduced and confirmed by the legal establishment of Christianity. The office of supreme pontiff, which from the time of Numa to that of Augustus had always been exercised by one of the most eminent of the senators, was at length united to the imperial dignity. The first magistrate of the state, as often as he was prompted by superstition or policy, performed with his own hands the sacerdotal functions. Nor was there any order of priests, either at Rome or in the provinces, who claimed a more sacred character among men, or a more intimate communication with the gods. But in the Christian Church, which entrusts the service of the altar to a perpetual succession of consecrated ministers, the monarch, whose spiritual rank is less honorable than that of the meanest deacon, was seated below the rails of the sanctuary, and confounded with the rest of the faithful multitude. The emperor might be saluted as the father of his people, but he owed a filial duty and reverence to the fathers of the church, and the same marks of respect which Constantine had paid to the persons of saints and confessors were soon exacted by the pride of the episcopal order. A secret conflict between the civil and ecclesiastical jurisdictions embarrassed the operation of the Roman government, and a pious emperor was alarmed by the guilt and danger of touching with a profane hand the Ark of the Covenant. The separation of men into the two orders of the clergy and of the laity was indeed familiar to many nations of antiquity, and the priests of India, of Persia, of Assyria, of Judea, of Ethiopia, of Egypt, and of Gaul, derived from a celestial origin the temporal power and possessions which they had acquired. These venerable institutions had gradually assimilated themselves to the manners and government of their respective countries, but the opposition or contempt of the civil power served to cement the discipline of the primitive church. The Christians had been obliged to elect their own magistrates, to raise and distribute a peculiar revenue, and to regulate the internal policy of their republic by a code of laws, which were ratified by the consent of the people and the practice of 300 years. When Constantine embraced the faith of the Christians, he seemed to contract a perpetual alliance with a distinct and independent society, and the privileges granted or confirmed by that emperor or by his successors were accepted, not as the precarious favors of the court, but as the just and inalienable rights of the ecclesiastical order. The Catholic Church was administered by the spiritual and legal jurisdiction of 1,800 bishops, of whom 1,000 were seated in the Greek and 800 in the Latin provinces of the empire. The extent and boundaries of their respective dioceses had been variously and accidentally decided by the zeal and success of the first missionaries, by the wishes of the people, and by the propagation of the gospel. Episcopal churches were closely planted along the banks of the Nile, on the seacoast of Africa, in the proconsular Asia, and through the southern provinces of Italy. The bishops of Gaul and Spain, of Thrace and Pontus, reigned over an ample territory, and delegated their rural suffragans to execute the subordinate duties of the pastoral office. A Christian diocese might be spread over a province or reduced to a village, but all the bishops possessed an equal and indelible character. They all derived the same powers and privileges from the apostles, from the people, and from the laws. While the civil and military professions were separated by the policy of Constantine, a new and perpetual order of ecclesiastical ministers, always respectable, sometimes dangerous, was established in the church and state. The important review of their station and attributes may be distributed under the following heads. 1. Popular election. 2. Ordination of the clergy. 3. Property. 4. Civil jurisdiction. 5. Spiritual censures. 6. Exercise of public oratory. 7. Privilege of legislative assemblies. The freedom of election subsisted long after the legal establishment of Christianity, and the subjects of Rome enjoyed in the church the privilege which they had lost in the Republic of choosing the magistrates whom they were bound to obey. As soon as a bishop had closed his eyes, the metropolitan issued a commission to one of his suffragans to administer the vacant see, and prepare, within a limited time, the future election. The right of voting was vested in the inferior clergy, who were best qualified to judge of the merit of the candidates. In the senators or nobles of the city, all those who were distinguished by their rank or property. And finally, in the whole body of the people, who, on the appointed day, flocked in multitudes from the most remote parts of the diocese, and sometimes silenced by their tumultuous acclamations the voice of reason and the laws of discipline. These acclamations might accidentally fix on the head of the most deserving competitor, of some ancient prester, some holy monk or some layman, conspicuous for his zeal and piety. But the episcopal chair was solicited especially in the great and opulent cities of the empire as a temporal rather than as a spiritual dignity. The interested views, the selfish and angry passions, the arts of perfidy and dissimulation, the secret corruption, the open and even bloody violence which had formerly disgraced the freedom of election in the commonwealths of Greece and Rome, too often influenced the choice of the successors of the apostles. While one of the candidates boasted the honors of his family, a second allured his judges by the delicacies of a plentiful table, and a third, more guilty than his rivals, offered to share the plunder of the church among the accomplices of his sacrilegious hopes. The civil as well as ecclesiastical laws attempted to exclude the populace from this solemn and important transaction. The canons of ancient discipline, by requiring several episcopal qualifications of age, station, etc., restrained in some measure the indiscriminate caprice of the electors. The authority of the provincial bishops, who were assembled in the vacant church to consecrate the choice of the people, was interposed to moderate their passions and to correct their mistakes. The bishops could refuse to ordain an unworthy candidate, and the rage of contending factions sometimes accepted their impartial mediation. The submission or the resistance of the clergy and people on various occasions afforded different precedents, which were insensibly converted into positive laws and provincial customs. But it was everywhere admitted as a fundamental maxim of religious policy that no bishop could be imposed on an Orthodox church without the consent of its members. The emperors, as the guardians of the public peace, and as the first citizens of Rome and Constantinople, might effectually declare their wishes in the choice of a primate, but those absolute monarchs respected the freedom of ecclesiastical elections, and while they distributed and resumed the honors of the state and army, they allowed 1,800 perpetual magistrates to receive their important offices from the free suffrages of the people. It was agreeable to the dictates of justice that these magistrates should not desert an honorable station from which they could not be removed. But the wisdom of councils endeavored, without much success, to enforce the residence and to prevent the translation of bishops. The discipline of the West was indeed less relaxed than that of the East, but the same passions which made those regulations necessary rendered them ineffectual. The reproaches which angry prelates have so vehemently urged against each other serve only to expose their common guilt and their mutual indiscretion. The bishops alone possessed the faculty of spiritual generation, and this extraordinary privilege might compensate in some degree for the painful celibacy which was imposed as a virtue, as a duty, and at length as a positive obligation. The religions of antiquity, which established a separate order of priests, dedicated a holy race, a tribe, or family to the perpetual service of the gods. Such institutions were founded for possession rather than conquest. The children of the priests enjoyed, with proud and indolent security, their sacred inheritance, and the fiery spirit of enthusiasm was abated by the cares, the pleasures, and the endearments of domestic life. But the Christian sanctuary was open to every ambitious candidate who aspired to its heavenly promises or temporal possessions. This office of priests, like that of soldiers or magistrates, was strenuously exercised by those men whose temper and abilities had prompted them to embrace the ecclesiastical profession, or who had been selected by a discerning bishop as the best qualified to promote the glory and interest of the church. The bishops, till the abuse was restrained by the prudence of the laws, might constrain the reluctant and protect the distressed, and the imposition of hands forever bestowed some of the most valuable privileges of civil society. The whole body of the Catholic clergy, more numerous perhaps than the legions, was exempted by the emperors from all service, private or public, all municipal offices, and all personal taxes and contributions which pressed on their fellow citizens with intolerable weight. And the duties of their holy profession were accepted as a full discharge of their obligations to the Republic. Each bishop acquired an absolute and indefeasible right to the perpetual obedience of the clerk whom he ordained. The clergy of each episcopal church, with its dependent parishes, formed a regular and permanent society, and the cathedrals of Constantinople and Carthage maintained their peculiar establishment of 500 ecclesiastical ministers. Their ranks and numbers were insensibly multiplied by the superstition of the times, which introduced into the church the splendid ceremonies of a Jewish or pagan temple, and a long train of priests, deacons, subdeacons, acolytes, exorcists, readers, singers, and doorkeepers contributed, in their respective stations, to swell the pomp and harmony of religious worship. The clerical name and privileges were extended to many pious fraternities who devoutly supported the ecclesiastical throne. 600 parabolani, or adventurers, visited the sick at Alexandria. 1100 copieti, or grave diggers, buried the dead at Constantinople, and the swarms of monks who arose from the Nile overspread and darkened the face of the Christian world. The Edict of Milan secured the revenue as well as the peace of the church. The Christians not only recovered the lands and houses of which they had been stripped by the persecuting laws of Diocletian, but they acquired a perfect title to all the possessions which they had hitherto enjoyed by the connivance of the magistrate. As soon as Christianity became the religion of the emperor and the empire, the national clergy might claim a decent and honorable maintenance, and the payment of an annual tax might have delivered the people from the more oppressive tribute which superstition imposes on her votaries. But as the wants and expenses of the church increased with her prosperity, the ecclesiastical order was still supported and enriched by the voluntary oblations of the faithful. 8 years after the Edict of Milan, Constantine granted to all his subjects the free and universal permission of bequeathing their fortunes to the Holy Catholic Church. Then their devout liberality, which during their lives was checked by luxury or avarice, flowed with a profuse stream at the hour of their death. The wealthy Christians were encouraged by the example of their sovereign. An absolute monarch who is rich without patrimony may be charitable without merit, and Constantine too easily believed that he should purchase the favor of heaven if he maintained the idle at the expense of the industrious, and distributed among the saints the wealth of the Republic. The same messenger who carried over to Africa the head of Maxentius might be entrusted with an epistle to Caecilian, bishop of Carthage. The emperor acquaints him that the treasurers of the province are directed to pay into his hands the sum of 3,000 poles, or £18,000 sterling, and to obey his further requisitions for the relief of the churches of Africa, Numidia, and Mauritania. The liberality of Constantine increased in a just proportion to his faith and to his vices. He assigned in each city a regular allowance of corn to supply the fund of ecclesiastical charity, and the persons of both sexes who embraced the monastic life became the peculiar favorites of their sovereign. The Christian temples of Antioch, Alexandria, Jerusalem, Constantinople, etc., displayed the ostentatious piety of a prince, ambitious in a declining age to equal the perfect labors of antiquity. The form of these religious edifices was simple and oblong. Though they might sometimes swell into the shape of a dome and sometimes branch into the figure of a cross. The timbers were framed, for the most part, of cedars of Libanus. The roof was covered with tiles, perhaps with gilt brass, and the walls, the columns, the pavement were encrusted with variegated marbles. The most precious ornaments of gold and silver, of silk and gems, were profusely dedicated to the service of the altar, and this specious magnificence was supported on the solid and perpetual basis of landed property. In the space of 2 centuries, from the reign of Constantine to that of Justinian, the 1800 churches of the empire were enriched by the frequent and unalienable gifts of the prince and people. An annual income of £600 sterling may be reasonably assigned to the bishops, who were placed at an equal distance between riches and poverty. But the standard of their wealth insensibly rose with the dignity and opulence of the cities which they governed. An authentic but imperfect rent roll specifies some houses, shops, gardens, and farms which belonged to the 3 basilicae of Rome, St. Peter, St. Paul, and St. John Lateran, in the provinces of Italy, Africa, and the East. They produce, besides, a reserved rent of oil, linen, paper, aromatics, etc., a clear annual revenue of 22,000 pieces of gold, or £12,000 sterling. In the age of Constantine and Justinian, the bishops no longer possessed, perhaps they no longer deserved, the unsuspecting confidence of their clergy and people. The ecclesiastical revenues of each diocese were divided into 4 parts for the respective uses of the bishop himself, of his inferior clergy, of the poor, and of the public worship. And the abuse of this sacred trust was strictly and repeatedly checked. The patrimony of the church was still subject to all the public compositions of the state. The clergy of Rome, Alexandria, Caesarea, etc., might solicit and obtain some partial exemptions, but the premature attempt of the Great Council of Rimini, which aspired to universal freedom, was successfully resisted by the son of Constantine. The Latin clergy, who erected their tribunal on the ruins of the civil and common law, have modestly accepted as the gift of Constantine the independent jurisdiction which was the fruit of time, of accident, and of their own industry. But the liberality of the Christian emperors had actually endowed them with some legal prerogatives which secured and dignified the sacerdotal character. Under a despotic government, the bishops alone enjoyed and asserted the inestimable privilege of being tried only by their peers, and even in a capital accusation, a synod of their brethren were the sole judges of their guilt or innocence. Such a tribunal, unless it was inflamed by personal resentment or religious discord, might be favorable or even partial to the sacerdotal order. But Constantine was satisfied that secret impunity would be less pernicious than public scandal, and the Nicene Council was edited by his public declaration that if he surprised a bishop in the act of adultery, he should cast his imperial mantle over the episcopal sinner. The domestic jurisdiction of the bishops was at once a privilege and a restraint of the ecclesiastical order, whose civil causes were decently withdrawn from the cognizance of a secular judge. Their venial offences were not exposed to the shame of a public trial or punishment, and the gentle correction which the tenderness of youth may endure from its parents or instructors was inflicted by the temperate severity of the bishops. But if the clergy were guilty of any crime which could not be sufficiently expiated by their degradation from an honorable and beneficial profession, the Roman magistrate drew the sword of justice without any regard to ecclesiastical immunities. The arbitration of the bishops was ratified by a positive law, and the judges were instructed to execute, without appeal or delay, the episcopal decrees whose validity had hitherto depended on the consent of the parties. The conversion of the magistrates themselves and of the whole empire might gradually remove the fears and scruples of the Christians, but they still resorted to the tribunal of the bishops, whose abilities and integrity they esteemed, and the venerable Austin enjoyed the satisfaction of complaining that his spiritual functions were perpetually interrupted by the invidious labor of deciding the claim or the possession of silver and gold, of lands and cattle. The ancient privilege of sanctuary was transferred to the Christian temples and extended by the liberal piety of the younger Theodosius to the precincts of consecrated ground. The fugitive and even guilty suppliants were permitted to implore either the justice or the mercy of the deity and his ministers. The rash violence of despotism was suspended by the mild interposition of the church, and the lives or fortunes of the most eminent subjects might be protected by the mediation of the bishop. The bishop was the perpetual censor of the morals of his people. The discipline of penance was digested into a system of canonical jurisprudence, which accurately defined the duty of private or public confession, the rules of evidence, the degrees of guilt, and the measure of punishment. It was impossible to execute this spiritual censure if the Christian pontiff, who punished the obscure sins of the multitude, respected the conspicuous vices and destructive crimes of the magistrate, but it was impossible to arraign the conduct of the magistrate without controlling the administration of civil government. Some considerations of religion, or loyalty, or fear, protected the sacred persons of the emperors from the zeal or resentment of the bishops, but they boldly censured and excommunicated the subordinate tyrants who were not invested with the majesty of the purple. Saint Athanasius excommunicated one of the ministers of Egypt, and the interdict which he pronounced of fire and water was solemnly transmitted to the churches of Cappadocia. Under the reign of the younger Theodosius, the polite and eloquent Synesius, one of the descendants of Hercules, filled the episcopal seat of Ptolemais, near the ruins of ancient Cyrene, and the philosophic bishop supported with dignity the character which he had assumed with reluctance. He vanquished the monster of Libya, the president Andronicus, who abused the authority of a venal office, invented new modes of rapine and torture, and aggravated the guilt of oppression by that of sacrilege. After a fruitless attempt to reclaim the haughty magistrate by mild and religious admonition, Synesius proceeds to inflict the last sentence of ecclesiastical justice, which devotes Andronicus with his associates and their families to the abhorrence of earth and heaven. The impenitent sinners, more cruel than Phalaris or Sennacherib, more destructive than war, pestilence, or a cloud of locusts, are deprived of the name and provinces of Christians, of the participation of the sacraments, and of the hope of paradise. The bishop exhorts the clergy, the magistrates, and the people to renounce all society with the enemies of Christ, to exclude them from their houses and tables, and to refuse them the common offices of life and the decent rites of burial. The Church of Ptolemais, obscure and contemptible as she may appear, addresses this declaration to all her sister churches of the world, and the profane who reject her decrees will be involved in the guilt and punishment of Andronicus and his impious followers. These spiritual terrors were enforced by dexterous application to the Byzantine court. The trembling president implored the mercy of the church, and the descendants of Hercules enjoyed the satisfaction of raising a prostrate tyrant from the ground. Such principles and such examples insensibly prepare the triumph of the Roman pontiffs, who have trampled on the necks of kings. Every popular government has experienced the effects of rude or artificial eloquence. The coldest nature is animated, the firmest reason is moved by the rapid communication of the prevailing impulse, and each hearer is affected by his own passions and by those of the surrounding multitude. The ruin of civil liberty had silenced the demagogues of Athens and the tribunes of Rome. The custom of preaching, which seems to constitute a considerable part of Christian devotion, had not been introduced into the temples of antiquity, and the ears of monarchs were never invaded by the harsh sound of popular eloquence, till the pulpits of the empire were filled with sacred orators who possessed some advantages unknown to their profane predecessors. The arguments and rhetoric of the tribune were instantly opposed with equal arms by skillful and resolute antagonists, and the cause of truth and reason might derive an accidental support from the conflict of hostile passions. The bishop or some distinguished praetor, to whom he cautiously delegated the powers of preaching, harangued, without the danger of interruption or reply, a submissive multitude whose minds had been prepared and subdued by the awful ceremonies of religion. Such was the strict subordination of the Catholic Church, that the same concerted sounds might issue at once from 100 pulpits of Italy or Egypt, if they were tuned by the master hand of the Roman or Alexandrian primate. The design of this institution was laudable, but the fruits were not always salutary. The preachers recommended the practice of the social duties, but they exalted the perfection of monastic virtue, which is painful to the individual and useless to mankind. Their charitable exhortations betrayed a secret wish that the clergy might be permitted to manage the wealth of the faithful for the benefit of the poor. The most sublime representations of the attributes and laws of the deity were sullied by an idle mixture of metaphysical subtleties, puerile rites, and fictitious miracles, and they expatiated with the most fervent zeal on the religious merit of hating the adversaries and obeying the ministers of the church. When the public peace was distracted by heresy and schism, the sacred orators sounded the trumpet of discord, and perhaps of sedition. The understandings of their congregations were perplexed by mystery, their passions were inflamed by invectives, and they rushed from the Christian temples of Antioch or Alexandria, prepared either to suffer or to inflict martyrdom. The corruption of taste and language is strongly marked in the vehement declamations of the Latin bishops, but the compositions of Gregory and Chrysostom have been compared with the most splendid models of Attic, or at least of Asiatic, eloquence. The representatives of the Christian Republic were regularly assembled in the spring and autumn of each year, and these synods diffused the spirit of ecclesiastical discipline and legislation through the 120 provinces of the Roman world. The archbishop, or metropolitan, was empowered by the laws to summon the suffragan bishops of his province, to revise their conduct, to vindicate their rights, to declare their faith, and to examine the merits of the candidates who were elected by the clergy and people to supply the vacancies of the episcopal college. The primates of Rome, Alexandria, Antioch, Carthage, and afterwards Constantinople, who exercised a more ample jurisdiction, convened the numerous assembly of their dependent bishops. But the convocation of great and extraordinary synods was the prerogative of the emperor alone. Whenever the emergencies of the church required this decisive measure, he dispatched a peremptory summons to the bishops or the deputies of each province with an order for the use of post-horses and a competent allowance for the expenses of their journey. At an early period, when Constantine was the protector rather than the proselyte of Christianity, he referred the African controversy to the Council of Arles, in which the bishops of York, of Trier, of Milan, and of Carthage met as friends and brethren to debate in their native tongue on the common interest of the Latin or Western Church. 11 years afterwards, a more numerous and celebrated assembly was convened at Nice in Bithynia to extinguish, by their final sentence, the subtle disputes which had arisen in Egypt on the subject of the Trinity. 318 bishops obeyed the summons of their indulgent master. The ecclesiastics of every rank and sect and denomination have been computed at 2,048 persons. The Greeks appeared in person, and the consent of the Latins was expressed by the legates of the Roman pontiff. The session, which lasted about 2 months, was frequently honored by the presence of the emperor. Leaving his guards at the door, he seated himself, with the permission of the council, on a low stool in the midst of the hall. Constantine listened with patience and spoke with modesty, and while he influenced the debates, he humbly professed that he was the minister, not the judge, of the successors of the apostles who had been established as priests and as gods upon earth. Such profound reverence of an absolute monarch towards a feeble and unarmed assembly of his own subjects can only be compared to the respect with which the Senate had been treated by the Roman princes who adopted the policy of Augustus. Within the space of 50 years, a philosophic spectator of the vicissitudes of human affairs might have contemplated Tacitus in the Senate of Rome and Constantine in the Council of Nice. The fathers of the capital and those of the church had alike degenerated from the virtues of their founders, but as the bishops were more deeply rooted in the public opinion, they sustained their dignity with more decent pride, and sometimes opposed with a manly spirit the wishes of their sovereign. The progress of time and superstition erased the memory of the weakness, the passion, the ignorance which disgraced these ecclesiastical synods, and the Catholic world has unanimously submitted to the infallible decrees of the general councils. Chapter 21. Persecution of Heresy. The Schism of the Donatists. The Arian Controversy. Athanasius. Distracted State of the Church and Empire under Constantine and his Sons. Toleration of Paganism. The grateful applause of the clergy has consecrated the memory of a prince who indulged their passions and promoted their interest. Constantine gave them security, wealth, honors, and revenge. And the support of the Orthodox faith was considered as the most sacred and important duty of the civil magistrate. The Edict of Milan, the great charter of toleration, had confirmed to each individual of the Roman world the privilege of choosing and professing his own religion. But this inestimable privilege was soon violated. With the knowledge of truth, the emperor imbibed the maxims of persecution, and the sects which dissented from the Catholic Church were afflicted and oppressed by the triumph of Christianity. Constantine easily believed that the heretics who presumed to dispute his opinions or to oppose his commands were guilty of the most absurd and criminal obstinacy, and that a seasonable application of moderate severities might save those unhappy men from the danger of an everlasting condemnation. Not a moment was lost in excluding the ministers and teachers of the separated congregations from any share of the rewards and immunities which the emperor had so liberally bestowed on the Orthodox clergy. But as the sectaries might still exist under the cloud of royal disgrace, the conquest of the East was immediately followed by an edict which announced their total destruction. After a preamble filled with passion and reproach, Constantine absolutely prohibits the assemblies of the heretics and confiscates their public property to the use either of the revenue or of the Catholic Church. The sects against whom the imperial severity was directed appear to have been the adherents of Paul of Samosata, the Monotists of Phrygia, who maintained an enthusiastic succession of prophecy, the Novatians, who sternly rejected the temporal efficacy of repentance, the Marcionites and Valentinians, under whose leading banners the various Gnostics of Asia and Egypt had insensibly rallied, and perhaps the Manichaeans, who had recently imported from Persia a more artful composition of Oriental and Christian theology. The design of extirpating the name, or at least of restraining the progress of these odious heretics, was prosecuted with vigor and effect. Some of the penal regulations were copied from the edicts of